There and welcome back to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast, sponsored as always by those rather lovely people at Natural Grower. Now, Natural Grower supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and your houseplants. They're absolutely crammed with certified organic growing power, and if you're looking for amazing results with all of your fruit and veg, your flower beds and houseplants, their Natural Grower's award-winning, certified, organic, peat-free compost and fertiliser are the very best you can buy. And your plants and gardens will love you for using it. All products are certified organic, they're 100% chemical-free and 100% peat-free. And those rather lovely people at Natural Grower have given me an exclusive 15% discount off all products for my listeners. Just pop MIC15 into the apply coupon field when you check out. In this week's episode, I speak to award-winning garden designer, writer, speaker, and now author, and a great friend of mine, Manoj Molde. Manoj's new book, Your Outdoor Room, is published by Francis Lincoln on the 21st of March, and it's a wonderful one-stop book that allows you to think about designing your own garden. It literally covers everything you need to know, from hard landscaping to planting and then maintenance. In our chat, we talk about the book, Manoj's Chelsea Flower Show gardens, his TV work, and of course, lots more. So, without any further ado, here's our chat. Well, today, I'm welcoming to the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast award-winning garden designer, writer, public speaker, top awards host, and now author Manoj Molde. Manoj, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming along and having a chat with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is very exciting.
So your new book, a copy of which I have right in front of me, he says, reaching, Your Outdoor Room, How to Design a Garden You Can Live In, published by Francis Lincoln on the 21st of March, 2024. How does it feel now adding author to your CV?
Do you know, it's something that I actually never imagined would happen in my wildest dreams. I don't know. It feels a bit weird, actually. And I think it's going to feel even more weird when I go into a bookshop and I actually see it on the shelf. That's going to be the surreal moment. Because when I was at school, I was always a creative. I wasn't necessarily academic. My two brothers are very academic, and I was always the creative one. So I've kind of studied and I've done my degrees and what have you, and I've studied garden design, of course. But I've always been in the creative field, and I never thought that writing would be something, especially a book, would be something that I would ever do. I write blogs, and I kind of think that's how this has kind of come about, because of course what happened through my career is that I started designing gardens. I then obviously did Chelsea, and then did TV. My career kind of then started extending out into TV.
Yeah.
And I think it was that actually got the attention of certain people, and certainly the publishers, the editor approached me and said, you don't know me, but I know you. I know of your work, and I've seen you on TV, and I've also been onto your website and read some of your blogs. She said, I've got this idea for a book, and I think you're going to be the perfect person to write it. And at that point, I just chuckled, because I said to her, Alice, you do know that I've never written a book before, don't you? She said, yes, but if you can put down on paper how you explain things on TV, then you will be able to write this book. And she said, and I've read your blogs, and I know that you know how to write. So I think you will be able to do it. And I kind of at that moment thought, you know what? How often do these opportunities come to people in their lifetime? You know, and I've always been kind of a bit of a go-getter and somebody who is always willing to have a go. And so I thought, you know what? Let's do it. Let's see how we get on. So my reaction then was, okay, let's have a meeting, and then you can explain to me what my remit would be in writing this book. So we met. My agent Bora was there as well, and Alice explained to me, you know, what would be expected of me in writing this book. She also showed me a couple of examples of other authors, and then she said, "Oh, and it's about 30,000 words," which when I went, "What?"
So,
It
when
was
you're
like,
writing your blog, how many words would you write on a blog post? Because there's a big difference between a blog post and a book. It's
absolutely.
stratospheric.
Yeah, so I generally tend to do my blogs at anywhere between 700 to 1700. But 30,000 is a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, that's quite a lot of words, isn't it? So these conversations about the book, how long ago did they start? When did this process actually start?
This started, I think, if I remember correctly, I think it was in. Towards the end of 2021, I would need to check the exact date, but it was 2021. That's when the conversation started, and like when we met, she explained to me that, you know, obviously I would need to do a sample chapter and kind of my ideas of the headings of each chapter to give them an idea of what I was going to be writing about. So I did all of that, and it was amazing because actually, when I did my sample chapter, even my sample chapter ended up being 11,000 words. So
That's a third of the book.
And it was at that point I kind of thought, oh, do you know what? I can do this. If I can do 11,000 words for one chapter, I can do 30,000 words. And so yeah, I kind of felt a bit more comfortable because I was slightly panicking when she said 30,000 words. But yeah, it was fine. And do you know what? I have a complete newfound appreciation and respect for editors because I sent this to Alice. Alice kind of did editing of the chapter, and she literally, like, she moved certain paragraphs around and sentences around and maybe took a few bits away. And then she sent it back to me to have a look at. And I just went, oh my God, this really flows well. And I kind of thought, is this really my work? Because, you know, and this is what editors are so good at. It's just amazing how they kind of chop and change things around, and all of a sudden, it just flows.
Yeah, let's give a massive shout out to all the editors out there who
Oh
take
my
our
God.
words and then work magic with
Oh,
them.
absolutely. I mean, God, that is such a skill and art form to do that. And yeah, when this chapter came back, I was like, my God, this is actually quite incredible. I'd buy this book.
I want to come back to the book and your TV career and Chelsea, but I want to take you back at this point to your childhood. Where exactly were you brought up, and how important was your heritage to how you've gone forward with your career?
So I was born in Mombasa in Kenya. Which I still do miss. I love Mombasa. I love Kenya.
I love Kenya. I've been there a few times. It's a lovely place.
Oh, it's beautiful. And I'm, being born in Mombasa, I'm a coastal baby, so I have a real affinity with the sea and anywhere near water. I absolutely love it. But also with Kenya, you've got that lovely tropical fauna and flora. You've got the amazing tribes of Kenya as well. And in fact, I remember my final collection that I did at the Royal College of Art when I was doing fashion. I'd actually based it on the Maasai. I just think the Maasai of Kenya are just incredible. I love all of their beaded ornaments and kind of like the toga type clothing that they wear, and how they kind of paint their legs and all of that, and the warriors and their hair, the way they plait them. And it's just incredible. I just think they're stunning, absolutely stunning. And equally the Samburu and the Turkana, and then of course there's the wildlife of Kenya as well. And Mike, can you believe that I have actually, throughout my whole life, I have never ever been to a zoo, never. And I've never wanted to go to a zoo, because I have experienced, and I've had the privilege of experiencing, should I say, animals in the wild. Lions, cheetahs, buffaloes, elephants, antelope, gazelles, all of that. I've kind of seen them in the wild. So I never have this longing to go to a zoo and see animals in cages, in confined environments. I know zoos have a very important part to play. So nothing against zoos, but because I've experienced these incredible animals in the wild, I want to keep that in my mind.
Well, I remember going to Tsavo and just being blown away when that first sighting of a herd of elephants who run in front of you. It's just the most incredible experience. And to this day, and this was quite a few years ago, I still remember that, and I can feel the goosebumps now as I say that. Just it's just not comparable with the zoo. But as you say, there is a place for zoos.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I've experienced the wildebeest migration in the Mara, and that is something to see. When you see like these millions and millions of wildebeest moving together, and literally they arrive at the river and they're waiting to cross just at the right opportunity, and it's incredible. To watch a leopard, and leopards are very rare, and they, because they remain hidden quite a lot. But I've actually seen a leopard at a watering hole, and drinking water, and it is the most amazing sight. It really is. I absolutely love going to the Mara. It's such a beautiful place, and I would advise anyone to actually experience that in their lifetime if they can. But my heritage is Indian, which I'm very, very proud of. And in fact, with that, it's amazing, because as I get older, I actually want to know more about my heritage as well, and I do everything and anything to explore that. And I guess this kind of came to a head when I did my first garden at the Chelsea Flower Show,
Beneath a Moroccan sky.
beneath a Mexican sky.
Mexican sky, I beg your pardon. I've got that written down here as well. I just can't read.
And somebody actually asked me a question and said, what attracts you to these bold colors? And at the time, I didn't really have an answer for them. But that light bulb moment happened one day when I opened my mom's wardrobe, and there were all of her beautiful saris hanging in the wardrobe. And it was then that I suddenly thought, of course, it's my heritage. And when you combine the Indian heritage with the African heritage, the Kenyan heritage, you kind of think, well, it's an obvious. I've been surrounded by color all my life. As in my childhood, I was surrounded by women in beautiful saris, and so now I feel subconsciously that color comes out in my work. And I'm not shy of it, and I play around with colors, and I guess in a way I have this hidden skill of making colors work together, which is what you see in India. When you go to India and you see the poorest of people who have virtually nothing, the way they just put colors together with just absolute confidence, and you kind of just think, oh my God, like I would never have thought of putting those colors together, but actually you make it work. And I kind of think that that's what's inside me, and I don't think about it. It kind of
It
just
just
comes.
happens. So as a child, this color that surrounded your life, when did you actually start to think about a career in fashion? Because that was your first port of call, a career in fashion call. Tell us about that. How did that come about?
I think by the age of 13, I actually knew that I wanted a career in fashion.
Gosh, that's really young.
And I knew that actually everything that I did with my studies was going to aim towards having a career in fashion. As a young child, I was always into, remember, although I was born in the late 60s, I was very much a 70s child. I love the flares and the wing collars and the platforms and all of
Oh
that.
gosh, you're taking us back now. You're making me think about flares and platform shoes.
And I love that. Do you remember the men with those sort of lovely bushy handlebar moustaches? I know
Oh
that's very
gosh, oh,
Kenyan,
yes.
but I still think that is absolutely cool. I
Well,
really
yeah,
think.
I mean, it was just so sort of archetypal of the time, that 70s, the sort of, well, it was the YMCA. We had sort of like that sort of
Absolutely.
like the leather, the handlebar
Yes,
tash, and
exactly. The open shirts with the big metal.
gosh, you're taking me back now.
I absolutely love that look. I think it's genius. I really do. But yeah, so at the age of 13, I kind of knew that that's what I really wanted to do. And so everything that I did in terms of my studies aimed towards that. And then my parents decided to move whilst I was in the middle of studying for my O level. So I had to change schools. My curriculums all changed as well. But I had decided that I didn't really want to remain, even if I went on to do my A levels, I didn't really want to remain at school. I would have gone to college. Unfortunately, the school that I moved to was a horrible all-boys school, and I hated my year there. I know hate sounds like a strong word, but I seriously did hate my school, my last year. And I clearly remember the year head saying, "Minojana, we think you're going to do really well at your A levels, and we would like you to stay on and do your A levels with us." And my instant reaction was, "You could not pay me to stay here." So I'd applied for both foundation courses as well as BTEC National in fashion. And funny enough, I got onto both courses, but because I knew that I actually wanted to have a career in fashion, I actually went and did my BTEC National in fashion design. And after that, I went on to doing my BA honours at the University of Westminster, and then I went on to the Royal College to do my master's in fashion fine. And then eventually, after I graduated, my first job took me to Italy. And that's where I worked. Within the fashion industry, I've worked in various different places. I've worked in Italy, I've worked in New York, I've worked in Germany, I've worked in Hong Kong, and actually working in Hong Kong then kind of took me to offices in India. I've traveled to South Korea, Taiwan, I've been to Indonesia,
Goodness.
so all like sourcing materials and things, going to factories to see how textiles are being produced. So yeah, it's been amazing. And I spent 18 years in the fashion industry, slowly climbing up the ladder. Went from junior designer to senior designer, then design manager. Then I became senior manager, and then eventually ended up as creative director. So
But
which was
after 18 years in such an incredible business, and so many people aspire to go into fashion, you were obviously making great strides. What happened? Why did you walk away?
So I got to a point where I could really see what was happening in fashion, especially at the high street end. And it wasn't a pretty picture. And I thought, do you know what? I don't really want to become a miserable old man in this industry. So maybe it's time to move on and go and do something for myself.
And from fashion, you headed to the Rosemary Alexandra's English Gardening School to study garden design. So,
I did.
had that been something that had been in your mind? How did the gardening thing weave into the fashion background?
So, I mean, I was always into gardening, and in fact, my gardening journey started again in childhood. I mean, I do have memories of our enormous balcony in Mombasa, where my dad used to grow a lot of plants and things. But I guess the real journey started when we had our first house in the UK. And we had a back garden, and we had a front garden, but we had a back garden. And notice we had a front garden,
Well, I'm going to just,
not a
having read
paved
your
drive
book.
as a car park space. We actually had a garden, a front garden.
And you reference this in your book, as you say, in 1973, I was 10 years old then. People had front gardens and there was some neighborly rivalry between neighbors trying to have the best front garden. Those days have
Exactly.
sort of gone. The front
Yeah.
garden is a front car parking space, which is.
You see, and it's such a shame. You know, I mean, I live in a lovely, lovely area, and I walk, I take my pup for a walk along probably one of the most expensive roads around this area. And I just see these houses where the frontages are so sterile because literally they are just paved over and there's just cars there. And that's it. There's no greenery, there's nothing growing there. And you kind of just think, where's the pride? You
I
know?
remember those days when, well, dahlias were very popular in the 70s, and there would be
Mm.
gardens full of dahlias. It would be a multicolored riot, which
Yeah.
isn't for me, but it could be for others. But the
Yeah.
fact was, it was a garden rather than a car parking space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, that I think having actual front gardens brings a certain sense of pride into an area. You know, and it's funny because I think the Americans do it really well. It's something that actually, funny enough, they do well.
They do actually. Yeah, you're
Yeah,
right.
because they think about curb appeal, and we don't think about curb appeal. You know, we think about car parking spaces. Hello. You know.
Well, it's the combo is usually a car and then the bins, a collection of blue, black, green bins. I
Yeah.
mean, really, it's
Exactly.
come back front gardens.
Totally, and comeback hedges as well.
Yeah.
When I moved to this country, every single house, the border, the borderline was hedges, not fences and walls. We
Yeah.
had hedges between houses, which gave you instant greenery, gave you habitat for wildlife, all of that.
I remember there being a privet hedge between most of the gardens on the first
That's
road
it.
we lived in as a family. Privet
Yeah.
hedges, but they were
Yeah.
green.
Yes. Yeah. And I kind of miss that, and I think we should have more hedges. And actually, do you know what? Does everyone know that hedges actually help to slow down and mitigate flooding? And they are great at capturing pollutants,
Yeah.
more so than trees, because hedges are so compact, they capture the small particles. And why are we getting so much pollution and respiratory problems? Because we're getting rid of the things that actually really help us,
Yeah.
So I do think that we need to bring back hedges and front gardens.
So we digress. I was taking you back to Rosemary Alexandra's English Garden
Yes.
School. So you studied garden design, sort of like. So when you went to Rosemary to learn, were you thinking a career in garden design, or was it a stopgap, or how did that work?
No, it was very much about a career in garden design. And in fact, actually, I remember having a com before I started at school, I remember having a conversation with the late Simon Pyle, who was my vice principal. And I said to him, is it possible for me to carry on working and doing this course? Because of course we were in school 2 days a week. So I thought maybe I could do both. And he clearly asked me the question, Manoj, do you want to do this as a hobby or do you want to do this as a career? And I said to him, I'm looking at this as a career. And he said, in which case, you need to give up your job because you're going to be burning the midnight oil. You're going to be working 7 days a week. There is a lot of coursework to get through, and you're not going to be able to do all of that if you're working the rest of the days, and then trying to do your coursework as well. It's just not going to happen. And that was the reason why I then went and handed my resignation in, which was a big step. I remember a lot of my friends kind of said, "Are you mad doing
Yeah.
this? Because you're on a good salary, you love what you do." And I said, no, I can do it. I mean, even my brother said to me, Manoj, are you serious about this? Because you are on a good wage, and you love going out shopping and buying clothes, and you don't look at price tags. And I said, do you know what? I think I can actually live within my means. And in a way, it was a challenge that I was setting myself.
Yeah.
Can I do this? And I think I've proven quite clearly that I can.
But then you said earlier, your husband Clive says you have a good intuition and instinct for these things. And of course, knowing the rest of the story, how well
Yeah,
that paid off.
absolutely. I did the diploma in garden design at the English Gardening School, and what an amazing time that was. We had the most amazing lecturers, I have to say, just real experts in their
Yeah.
field. And then I went on to doing the plants and plantsmanship diploma at the English Gardening School, and that was incredible.
Yeah.
The course leader was Matt Biggs, who has become a friend of mine now. And again, we had the most amazing lectures, and it was a really worthwhile diploma to study. We even had the amazing Roy Lancaster come and teach us, and we went to some of the gardens, and he showed us how to do plant ident and stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely superb.
That pool of knowledge has obviously been key in you moving forward with your career. So when did you finish your exams, your studies with the English Gardening School?
So I finished the garden design diploma in 2011, and then straight away went on to doing the plants and plantsmanship diploma after that. And I finished the plants and plantsmanship diploma, I think, in 2012, or maybe early part of 2013, around there. Yeah.
So I'm going to
So,
fast forward just about 5 years. 2017, the
yes.
exquisite, the striking Beneath the Mexican Sky Garden at Chelsea. Now I remember that garden. How did that come about? Tell us about the concept and what was the thinking behind that wonderful garden.
So that was based on the amazing, amazing work of Mexican architect Luis Barragán. And I remember seeing Barragán's work. I was trawling through the internet, as you kind of do, not looking for anything in particular. And I came across images of his work, and they were so striking. So I started looking at whose work that was. I'd never heard of Barragán at that point. And I remember seeing this and thinking, wow, this must be some amazing young architect doing these incredibly contemporary buildings. And so I started looking into Barragán himself, and didn't realize that actually he'd already passed away. And so I researched his life, and it was amazing because Barragán spent a lot of his career trying to be accepted as an amazing architect in his field. And it wasn't until later on in his career that that actually happened. He really struggled to be accepted in his industry as well. And I loved the bold use of colors, those gorgeous walls. And I thought, do you know what? I'm gonna save some of these images, and one day I'm gonna create a garden at Chelsea inspired by his work. And that's exactly what I did. And I'd already kind of started doodling and sketching things out and all of that. And then eventually I arrived at something that I thought, ah, do you know what? That's a Chelsea garden. That's a show garden. So yes, by the time 2016 came around, and of course in 2016, I worked on Nick Bailey's Beauty and Mathematics Garden as a his one of his plant leaders, leading the planting team. And it was then that I kind of knew that I was ready to make my submission to Chelsea. And so I did that. I went ahead and submitted. And actually, I'll take you back a little bit. Before I was ready to do that submission, I got in touch with Tecwyn Evans at Living Landscapes, and he didn't know me at the time. And I showed it. I initially got in touch with him, and he said, "Look, I don't know you. I don't know your work. You know, obviously, it's my reputation at stake, all of this." And I said, "Yeah, absolutely get that. Give me 5 minutes of your time, just for a conversation. I just want to show you a design. And then if you say no, fine, I'll leave it." So we met, and I put this sketch down on the table. And before I could even begin to explain it, Tecwyn just said, "Now that I'm going to build for you." And it was like, whoa, that didn't even need an explanation. And I sent a plant list to Dave Root. Dave rang me the very next day, and he said, "I remember you. I met you 5 years ago at Chelsea, and you loved Isoplexis canariensis on Chris's garden." And I was like, "Oh my God, how on earth did you remember that?" And he just said, "Do you know what? I absolutely love your plant list, and I definitely want to work with you." So I had my nursery on board, I had my contractor on board. Finding a sponsor, oh my God, how difficult is that?
Well, I was going to ask about that. How does that work? Because when you submit your plans to the RHS, do you have to say that you have a sponsor or that you're actively looking for one? How does that work?
I think it helps if you have a sponsor. I think it helps if you have a sponsor, your contractor in place, and your nursery in place. You can submit and say still to be confirmed, but I know that had I been in that position, I would not have submitted because the last thing I want to do is for that design to be selected and I still don't have a sponsor. And then I have to turn around to the RHS and say, I'm really sorry, but I actually can't create that garden
Yeah.
because I don't have a sponsor. So I was really pleased that I did. And actually, it literally only happened probably a couple of weeks before I was supposed to submit. I had sent out so many packages, requesting for sponsorship, explaining what I want to do, all of this, CV, the sketch, all of that. And I only got four answers back, and all of them were no.
Goodness me.
And then I spoke to one of my clients. They were a property developer. And I explained what I wanted to do. And they said to me, Manoj, why don't you put the figures together and submit them to us? And if we can help, we will. So did that. And a week later, they came back to me and said, we can do this. We can sponsor your garden. So they ended up sponsoring my garden. And so I was able to make the submission to the RHS. And yeah, lo and behold, it went through and I ended up creating Beneath a Mexican Sky at Chelsea.
And the whole experience clearly didn't put you off because last year you returned to Chelsea, Main Avenue, with the RHS and Eastern Eye Garden of Unity, which a stunning garden, which I had the privilege to work along on the planting side of things. Tell us
Absolutely.
about that. How did that come together, and how did the 2017 garden help you in the whole process?
Well, I think, first of all, doing the garden in 2017 really gave me the confidence
Yeah.
of and kind of that just eagerness to do another garden at Chelsea. And I think with Chelsea, it's one of those things that you will either absolutely hate it and never want to do another one again, or as Ruth Wilmot said to me, you might catch the bug. And I definitely caught the bug. And I remember saying at the end of the Chelsea in 2017 that one day I will be back to do a garden on Main Avenue. And lo and behold, that kind of happened. And it was funny because I started having conversations, and this conversation just literally happened. It was the September Chelsea that the RHS did.
During
And
the
I
lockdown or after the
remember
lockdowns.
just after the lockdown,
Yeah.
and I remember I was walking up Royal Hospital Way, and I ended up having this conversation with some of the RHS staff, and I was told that I really should be doing a garden about inclusivity and diversity. And so my response to that was, find me the money and I will do it. And so I kind of left it at that point. And then in May, they got in touch with me and said, do you remember that conversation that we had? Well, now it is becoming real. We'd like to meet up with you to have a look at the contracts. And then away we go. As I say, the brief was about inclusivity and diversity. So I had to create a garden that actually personified that. And although the garden was inspired a lot from my childhood,
Yeah, the colours and
the colors and just kind of the experiences that I've had through my childhood. So, I was a North London boy, a huge Jewish community around there. So it was very important for me to, have Judaism and the Jewish community included in that garden. It was equally important for me to have, people from African and West Indian backgrounds included. I wanted the Islamic backgrounds. And I remember, when I was at school and I studied Islam for my religious education exams, and the one thing that had always stuck in my mind were the five pillars of Islam. And so in my garden last year, I ended up having five trees that represented the five pillars of Islam. And so it was ways of how to bring different communities in. LGBT was obviously included, not just through the colors, but kind of the fact that I'm gay and I'm designing the garden. And more so the fact that I actually ended up getting married on the garden as well.
Well, I was going to say the garden wasn't just for the public. It was a very special garden for you and Clive. You got married on press day. How was that? The first marriage, the first gay marriage, at Chelsea. Wow. How was the day on a personal level? Because it was a special day for you and Clive.
It was very, very special. Do you know, it's funny because I don't normally get nervous about things. I'm pretty confident in things that I do. But that day, and even Clive said to me, "Why are you shaking?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "You know, this is a big thing for me. It's a big thing for us." Clive and I have been together for what, 33, 34 years. And it took us 18 years to get engaged. And finally this was happening. So I was nervous. And also, it was happening, although it was very intimate, and it was very intimate. And thank you to the RHS for helping us make it intimate. It was still a very public affair.
It was.
Press day at Chelsea. Although the RHS had actually cordoned the area off, the amount of people with cameras there was amazing. But
Well,
it
I
was.
was stood on the other side, looking into the garden, and you say there was a throng of people and press and cameras on what was a very special, intimate moment for you and Clive. So,
Absolutely.
and of course, later in the day, you were visited by King Charles and Queen Camilla.
Yes, we were. And
At
in
his
fact,
request, I understand.
they requested to come and meet us. And actually, do you know what? They were wonderful. In fact, King Charles said, the first thing he said to us is, "What are you doing here? You should be on your honeymoon now." Yeah, we've been waiting for you.
Wow,
They
lovely
were
memories.
honestly, they were absolutely wonderful. And Queen Camilla, just incredible. Very softly spoken. And they're both really keen gardeners as well. They love horticulture. So it was honestly icing on the cake to meet them. Really, really lovely people.
You also have a TV career now. I'd love to talk about how that came about. Which was the first one that came about? How did that come about? How did it all work?
So there was a production company that actually rang me up and said to me that, we're putting together this program, and we'd really like you to be a part of it. Now, I've done a smidgen of TV in the past. I actually did do the summer special for Gardener's World, where they were looking into people from diverse backgrounds and what they grow and how they garden. And I was part of that. And that I really, really enjoyed. I really loved doing that and working with Gardener's World. It was fantastic. This production company had obviously seen snippets of me on TV, but they'd also seen my garden at Chelsea. And so
This
they
is the
got it.
first garden, obviously, for
This was my first job.
2017.
Yes. So they explained to me what this program was about. And I said, "Great. Can you actually send me some stuff? Like maybe there's a little short reel that you've done of the program." And they'd obviously already started Your Homemade Perfect. And so they sent me that. So I watched that and I thought, actually, do you know what? This is really, really interesting because if they do the garden version of this will actually show the public exactly how a garden is designed and constructed. It's reality. It's not budgets are real. They have real budgets to create these gardens, and that's what I really wanted, because I just didn't want to go down the route of misleading people about how gardens are created. And so I was really interested, and they obviously they put a package together for all the designers who were going to be on it. And yeah, that's how it all came about.
So beautifully designed gardens, which brings me to the book, Your Outdoor Room: How to Design a Garden You Can Live In. Tell us, who is the book for?
So really, the book, I've written it in such a way that it's actually for anyone and everyone who is keen on having a beautiful outdoor space. It's written in a really simple language, not loads of industry jargon. I didn't want it to be hard work for the reader. And in fact, I'd actually said to the publisher that I don't want any CAD drawings in there, because I find that CAD drawings can be quite scary. So I want hand drawings in there. So the book is actually for maybe somebody who's bought their first property. They've spent a lot of money on the property, and so they don't necessarily have the funds to engage a garden designer, but actually they're really keen to do it themselves, and they're really keen to do it right. So this book actually is like a guidance book, and it takes you, or I take you, through the step-by-step process of how to design your own garden. So it goes from how to actually survey your garden and how to do a site analysis, all the way through to then putting a concept together, how to create all of your different plans for the garden, how to select your materials, your plants. It even goes into things about sustainability and recycling, thinking about biodiversity, the do's and don'ts and why, how to think about themes for your garden, how to create that connection between the garden and your home, putting color palettes together and understanding how to put colors together, but also not to be scared of color, because I find that people are great at picking colors for their interiors. They can pick colors, they can pick wallpapers, they can pick soft furnishings. But when it comes to the outdoors, suddenly it scares them. And I'm not surprised, because the light is constantly changing outside. One minute there are no leaves on the trees, and then all of a sudden the canopy's full and it's creating shade, which affects the colors. And things are going up and down. Certain plants come up, then they die back, and others come up. So there's constant change in an outdoor space. So it does become a bit scary, but actually it needn't be.
And
And
I think,
so
yeah, that's what comes out in the book. A, as you say, it's not a scary book to read, because you think, oh, designing your own garden. It's in layman's terms, everything is covered. Like you say, right from the very beginning of the process, you can take this as a one-stop design your own garden
Absolutely.
book.
And I've even put in a link for annual maintenance as well. So people can look at that link, go into the link, and know what they need to do on what month in the garden. And there's a little supplies directory in the back as well. So if people need to find things, that then there's that as well to help.
So the book will be out on the shelves very soon. How are you going to feel actually seeing that you've worked on this for a good couple of years? You're going to be so proud to walk into the bookshop and see it on the shelves, aren't you?
Do you know what? I am so excited. I am really, really excited, because to be honest, you know, I put my heart and soul into this book,
Yeah.
and even down to some of the little motifs that are in the book, I've designed those. I've chosen the colors in the book. I've really enjoyed doing this book. It's been incredible. And do you know what? It's been lovely that actually Francis Lincoln have allowed me just the free rein on the book as well,
Yeah.
because you know I didn't think that that would happen, but they've literally let me direct this book right from the beginning right to the end, and you know when I look at it, you know you look at that book, and even if that name was not there, you'd know that actually that's a
Y you
Minaj
would. The colors.
Malde
It just
book.
sort of like I'm looking at the colors behind you from where you're speaking today. It's
Yeah.
colors on this book, the colors that you wear.
Exactly.
It's got your thumbprint on that book without your name being on there.
Yes. And that's what I wanted. I wanted a book that was not only going to be useful to people, but they were actually going to be proud to have it on their coffee table as
Yeah.
well. And I wanted a book that actually attracts people to pick it up, open it, and read it. And what I also did, and this is something that I discussed with the publishers, I didn't just want photographs of things that I've worked on. I wanted photos of gardens by other designers as well. Because, you know, let's face it, we all have different likes and dislikes. And so I wanted the book to appeal to as many people as possible so that everyone can get something out of it. And it's written in such a way that, you know, if you just wanted to design a planting scheme, well, you can go to that section in the book, read that, and do that. It doesn't mean that you have to start right from the beginning and read the whole book again. So you can dip in
Dip
and
in and
out,
out.
which is lovely. And so I really wanted it to be a practical book as well as a book that is full of like beautiful colors, beautiful motifs, beautiful photographs, and lots of useful information. I'm hoping that people will find this not only a joy to read, but really useful as well.
Oh, they will do without a shadow of a doubt. So that's Your Outdoor Room, How to Design a Garden You Can Live In, published by Francis Lincoln on the 21st of March. It will be
Yeah.
a surefire success. Before we go, I need to talk about the new man in your life,
Do you mean my
Barney.
baby?
We
Yeah,
need to talk
I was
about
going to say,
Barney, the
yeah. Give the other one,
adorable.
the
We'll talk afterwards. Now, tell us about Barney, the adorable double doodle.
Double doodle, absolutely. So he's a
Oh, he's
cross
so
between
lovely.
he's adorable. He's a cross between a labradoodle and a golden doodle.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, Clive and I absolutely love dogs. We've had dogs in our childhood, but never in our adult life. And you know, years ago we had actually talked about adopting a child, and sadly we were of the generation where it would have been very difficult for two men to adopt
Yeah.
a child. And we feel now it would be too late to do that, but we still wanted something that we call our own, and so we decided that that was it. We were gonna get a puppy, but more so, what actually happened was a few months after we got married, Clive's Mum sadly passed away, and Clive then decided that, do you know what, life's too short. If we're going to do something, let's not just talk about it, let's do it. So he found a breeder who'd had a litter, and Barney comes from a huge litter, 11 pups.
Oh, goodness me.
And all healthy, all really healthy.
Yeah.
And so he put a deposit down without actually telling me, and then He came up to me and he said, we're going this weekend to go and choose our pup. And I said, sorry? He said, yeah, I've put a deposit down on a puppy. And normally, if Clive is having fun, he would have a little smirk on his face, and I would recognize that. He didn't have that smirk, and I thought, you're really serious about this, aren't you?
Oh
And
dear.
yeah, we're going this weekend to pick our puppy. And so, do you know what? I thought, you're absolutely right. Life's too short. Let's get on with it. So that weekend, we went and chose Barney. He was 4 weeks when we chose him. We were going away for a short while, for a short break. He would have been 8 weeks on our return. And that was a good time for him to be separated from his mum. So we brought him home, and it was funny because my mum, who lives with us, what Clive and I take care of my mum. She was always, like, I don't want a dog, I don't want a dog. And when we brought him home and presented him to mum, the first thing she turned around and said was, "Oh, I love you," and. And I looked at Clive and I said, wow, that was a quick
Gosh,
turnaround.
really quick.
He absolutely adores him.
Minaj, thank you so much and good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My thanks to Minaj for taking time to come and chat to us today about his new book. So that's Your Outdoor Room: How to Design a Garden You Can Live In by Minaj Molde, and published by Francis Lincoln on the 21st of March. Now, as a garden designer, I've designed numerous gardens for my clients over the years, and so I wondered how many of you have designed a garden, your own garden or a garden for somebody else. If you have, drop me a line and let me know. And so now I'm heading out into my own garden to see how my seedlings are doing. Now, is it just me? Who, 5 minutes after sowing them, is out there checking to see if they've germinated? And then every hour on the hour. What is it with seedlings? Have to keep going back to have another look. So that's what I'm going to do now. Now, please don't forget to follow and subscribe, and if you're able, please do leave a review. And I will see you next week as usual. Bye bye for now. Bye bye.